A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's not hypothetical anymore. Iran enriches to weapons grade, 90%. The material exists. It's not yet a warhead, but it's in a physical form somewhere, under some kind of containment, and the clock is ticking. He's asking three things. What form is the uranium actually in at that stage? How is it being stored? And if the US or Israel were to attempt a raid to seize it, how would you even begin to pull that off? There's a lot to unpack here.
The reason this isn't academic is the IIII's quarterly report. As of early June, Iran's stockpile of 60% enriched uranium has hit 142 kilograms. The technical leap from 60% to 90%, that's a matter of days, not months. Maybe a week and a half in their advanced cascades. So the question of what you do when that material exists is suddenly very, very real.
Let's start with the material itself. 90% enriched uranium. What does it actually look like? Because I think most people picture a glowing green liquid in a sci-fi vial.
Right? That's the first misconception to kill. Weapons-grade uranium is a metal. Silvery gray, looks like cast iron, dense as lead, about 19.1 grams per cubic centimeter in metal form. It's chemically reactive, it oxidizes in air, and here's the thing that surprises people. It's not visibly radioactive in the way you'd expect. You can stand next to a bare ingot of highly enriched uranium and not immediately die. The alpha particles don't penetrate skin. The gamma signature is modest. The danger isn't the external radiation field. The danger is what happens if you bring two pieces too close together, or if you inhale the dust, or if it catches fire. Which it can do spontaneously under the right conditions.
Spontaneously, as in, you open a container and it just ignites.
If it's in the form of fine powder or machining swarf, yes. Uranium is pyrophoric. Those fine particles have enormous surface area. They react with oxygen exothermically, and they can auto-ignite at room temperature. This is a well-known problem in nuclear weapons manufacturing. The machining of a uranium pit generates fines that have to be managed under inert atmosphere or with cutting fluids that prevent oxidation. So when we talk about seizing this material, you're not grabbing a stable hunk of metal. You're dealing with something that can catch fire, create an airborne radiological hazard, and potentially go critical if you mishandle the geometry.
Walk me through the physical forms it could be in. Because the prompt asks what form it's in at the moment, enrichment hits 90%, and I'm guessing it's not a neatly machined sphere sitting on a shelf.
The output of the centrifuges is uranium hexafluoride gas UF6. That's what gets fed into the cascades. At the end of the enrichment process, you have UF6 gas that's 90% uranium-235. That gas is then condensed into a solid. UF6 is a white crystalline solid at room temperature and stored in steel cylinders. Those are the familiar cylinders you see in IAEI monitoring photos, about 30 inches in diameter, each holding maybe 10 to 15 kilograms of uranium by mass. So at this stage, the material is not a metal. It's a volatile, corrosive, chemically aggressive solid that reacts violently with water, releasing hydrogen fluoride gas, which is basically death in a cloud.
The first thing Iran has to do after enrichment is convert the UF6 into something usable for a weapon. That's not trivial.
That's the bottleneck, and it's where a lot of the raid logic centers. To make a weapon, you need uranium metal or at minimum uranium oxide that can be further processed. The conversion chain goes like this. UF6 is hydrolyzed, carefully, under controlled conditions, to uranyl fluoride, UO2F2. That's then reduced with hydrogen at about 600 degrees Celsius to uranium dioxide, UO2 powder. That's your ceramic grade material. The stuff used in reactor fuel, but for a weapon, you go further. You take that UO2 and reduce it again, this time with calcium or magnesium metal at 800 to 1000 degrees Celsius in what's called a bomb reduction vessel. The uranium metal collects as a regolith at the bottom. You then cast that into an ingot, machine it into a hemisphere or a pit shape, and mate it with a reflector.
That machining step is where the pyrophoric fines become a problem.
Every cut, every lathe pass produces uranium dust that can spontaneously ignite. Weapons labs handle this in glove boxes filled with argon or nitrogen. The machining is done slowly, with specialized tooling. This is not something you do in a garage. It requires a metallurgical infrastructure that is detectable by satellite. The building has to have specific ventilation, specific shielding, specific waste handling. And that brings us to the first major insight about the prompt scenario. The most dangerous moment, from a proliferation standpoint, is not the enrichment. It's the conversion from UF6 to metal. That's where you have material in transit between chemical forms, moving between buildings, potentially exposed to air or water or human error. And that's where a raid would ideally hit.
Because you're catching it before it becomes a compact, machined weapon component that's easier to hide or move.
A UF6 cylinder is big, heavy, and identifiable. A finished uranium pit is smaller than a bowling ball and fits in a backpack, so timing matters enormously. If Iran goes from UF6 to metal in a sprint, and they have the technical capability to do that, they've been working on uranium metallurgy for decades. You have a window of maybe 2 to 3 weeks where the material is in a vulnerable intermediate state. After that, you're looking for a much smaller, much more portable object.
Let's talk about critical mass, because that determines how much material we're actually trying to seize. You mentioned 142 kilograms of 60% enriched stockpile. What does that yield at 90%?
The math works like this. Enriching from 0.6%, which is the tails assay, up to 90% requires a certain amount of separative work. If you take 142 kilograms of 60% material and further enrich it to 90%, you end up with roughly 80 to 85 kilograms of weapons, grade uranium, depending on the tails you choose. Now, the critical mass of a bare sphere of 90% enriched uranium metal is about 52 kilograms. That's without a reflector. Add a beryllium reflector, which is what every weapon designer uses, and the critical mass drops to somewhere between 15 and 20 kilograms. So, 85 kilograms of HEU gives you 4 to 5 weapon cores, maybe more if you're using advanced designs with levitated pits or composite reflectors.
That's assuming no losses in the conversion process.
There will be losses. Conversion efficiency from UF6 to metal is never 100%. You lose material to hold up in pipes, to waste streams, to imperfect reduction yields. Realistically, from 142 kilograms of 60% stockpile, you're looking at maybe 3 to 4 actual weapon cores after enrichment, conversion, and machining. That's still a strategic arsenal. 4 weapons on 4 ballistic missiles changes the security calculus of the entire Middle East overnight.
We've established what the material looks like and how much there is. Now, the second part of the prompt, how is it being stored? Where is this stuff sitting while Iran waits to machine it into pits?
The storage question has 2 dimensions, the physical container and the location. Let's start with the container. Highly enriched uranium, whether in UF6 form or as oxide powder or as metal ingots, is stored in what are called Type B packages. These are stainless steel cylinders with double O-ring seals, tested to survive a 30-foot drop onto an unyielding surface, a puncture test, a fire test at 800 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes, and immersion in water. They're robust. For metal ingots, you typically store them in sealed cans under argon or nitrogen atmosphere inside a critically safe array.
What does critically safe array mean in practice?
It means the containers are spaced apart on racks at distances calculated to prevent neutron interaction. If you have multiple units of HEU metal, each one is subcritical by itself. But if you stack them too close together, neutrons from one can induce fissions in another, and you can get a chain reaction. So the storage vault is designed with geometry in mind. Fixed spacing, neutron-absorbing materials like borated aluminum between racks, and strict limits on how much mass can be in any one location. This is routine nuclear safety engineering. Every facility that handles HEU does this. The question is whether Iran's facilities are designed to the same standard. The 2 most likely sites are Fort Dow and Natanz. Fort Dow is the mountain bunker facility built into a mountain near Qom. It's hardened against airstrikes, buried under something like 80 meters of rock. Natanz is the main enrichment site, with underground halls that are also hardened but less deeply buried. Both have the infrastructure for UF6 handling. Neither, as far as open source intelligence can confirm, has a fully equipped uranium metallurgy facility. That would likely be at a separate covert site, possibly at Parchin, where Iran has done explosive testing relevant to weaponization, or at a new facility we haven't identified yet.
The material might be in one location for enrichment, move to a second for conversion, and move to a third for machining and assembly. That's a lot of transit points.
Each transit is a vulnerability. The material has to be loaded into a transport cask, moved by truck or rail, unloaded, and restored at the destination. During that movement, it's above ground, potentially exposed, and the security cordon is harder to maintain than at a fixed facility. If I'm planning a raid, I'm looking at those transit windows first.
Which brings us to the third part of the prompt, the raid itself. How do you seize this material safely from a hostile defended facility?
Let's be clear about what we're describing here. No modern military has ever attempted a hot seizure of weapons-grade nuclear material from a defended underground facility in hostile territory. The closest analog is Operation Desert Storm in 1991, when U.S. forces secured 27 kilograms of 93% enriched uranium from Iraq's Tawatha facility. But that was under permissive conditions, the war was effectively over, the facility was abandoned, and they had weeks to plan the extraction. Even then, the material was stored in 200-liter drums underwater, which is not how Iran is storing its material. A raid on Fordow or Natanz would be an entirely different animal.
What would the operational requirements be?
Let's break it down. You need to know the exact location of the material within the facility, down to which room and which rack. You need to know the container type, the mass, the chemical form, and the state of the facility's defenses. That means human intelligence on the ground, probably supplemented by technical collection. Cyber intrusion into the facility's inventory systems, satellite imagery of vehicle movements, radiation detection from overhead. The U.S. has specialized aircraft for this, the WC-135 Constant Phoenix, which can sniff atmospheric particulates for signatures of nuclear activity. But for a raid, you need granular, room-level intelligence, and that is extraordinarily hard to get.
Even harder if the facility is buried under 80 meters of rock.
Which is why Fordow is such a nightmare. You can't image through that much rock from a satellite. You need someone inside. And that someone has to be able to communicate out, which is itself a challenge given the facility's likely electronic warfare environment.
Assume you have the intelligence. What's the team look like?
You're talking about a special operations force, probably a reinforced company-sized element, 100 to 150 operators. They need radiation-hardened gear, which means dosimeters, portable criticality detectors, and protective suits that can handle potential UF6 or hydrogen fluoride releases. They need specialized handling equipment, remote manipulator arms for moving containers, shielded transport casks that can contain a criticality event if something goes wrong.
Those casks weigh what?
The NEST teams, that's the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, the U.S. Department of Energy's Nuclear Incident Response Unit, use transport containers that weigh up to 30 tons when loaded. You're not carrying that out by hand. You need heavy lift capability. An MH-47G Chinook can lift about 12 tons externally. So you're either bringing in ground vehicles to move the cask to an extraction point, or you're using multiple helicopters in a coordinated lift, or you're breaking the material into smaller, subcritical portions and moving them in multiple trips. Each option has its own risk profile.
All of this is happening while the facility is presumably defended.
That's the part that makes this terra incognita. Fordow is guarded by elements of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The perimeter is mined. There are air defense batteries in the surrounding hills. The facility itself has blast doors, security checkpoints, and presumably a self-destruct or denial capability. If the Iranians realize a seizure is underway, they have every incentive to destroy the material themselves, or to trigger a radiological release that makes the site inaccessible. So the raid has to achieve surprise, overwhelm the defenses, secure the material, and extract it before reinforcements arrive. We're talking about a window of maybe 90 minutes from insertion to extraction, and that's optimistic.
That's before we even get to the criticality risk during the seizure itself.
This is the part that keeps nuclear safety engineers up at night. If your team is moving containers of HEU metal and they accidentally bring two subcritical masses too close together, say a container gets dropped or the spacing isn't maintained during extraction, you can get a propped criticality event. That's a burst of neutron and gamma radiation that delivers a lethal dose in milliseconds. The most infamous example is the 1999 Tokaimura accident in Japan. Workers at a fuel processing facility poured too much urinal nitrate into a precipitation tank, creating a critical geometry. The most exposed worker received 17 gray. He died 83 days later from acute radiation syndrome. His chromosomes were literally shattered.
For context, a whole body dose of 5 gray is about 50% lethal without aggressive medical intervention.
And a prompt criticality event in a confined underground space with multiple operators nearby could incapacitate the entire team in a fraction of a second. You don't feel it. You might see a blue flash, Cherenkov radiation in the air and in your own eyeballs. And then, about 30 minutes later, the nausea hits and you know you're dead. It's a uniquely terrifying failure mode.
How do you prevent that?
With extremely careful handling protocols. The transport containers are designed with internal neutron absorbers, borated stainless steel, cadmium sheets, hafnium plates that prevent criticality even if the containers are stacked. The team carries portable neutron detectors that alarm if the count rate spikes. And the extraction plan is rehearsed in full-scale mock-ups using depleted uranium as a stand-in until every movement is muscle memory. The U.S. has facilities for this. The Nevada National Security Site, formerly the Nevada Test Site, has areas where you can build a full-scale replica of a target facility and practice the breach, the search, the container handling, and the extraction under realistic conditions.
You rehearse a raid that might never happen on a replica of a facility you may never enter for material you hope never exists.
That's the deterrence business. The preparation itself is part of the signal. If Iran knows that the U.S. and Israel have a practiced, credible capability to seize their material, that changes their calculus about whether to sprint for a weapon. The uncertainty about whether a raid is coming, and whether it would succeed, is itself a deterrent.
There's a strategic paradox here, isn't there? If you attempt the raid and fail, or if Iran detects the preparation, you might trigger the very launch you're trying to prevent.
That's the knife edge. Iran's doctrine, as far as we understand it, is to achieve a nuclear breakout capability, the ability to produce a weapon on short notice, rather than to actually assemble and deploy one. The red light has historically been weaponization, not enrichment. But if a raid is underway, the calculus changes. Iran might decide that the only way to salvage its investment is to rush to a deliverable weapon and use it before the facility is overrun, or to transfer the material to a proxy, or to a second, undisclosed site. The raid has to be so fast and so complete that Iran doesn't have time to react. That's the standard. Anything less, and you've made the situation worse.
Let's talk about the Israeli angle specifically. Israel has a different risk calculus than the US. A nuclear Iran is an existential threat to Israel in a way it isn't to the United States, which has strategic depth and its own overwhelming nuclear deterrent. Israel might be willing to accept risks in a raid that the US wouldn't.
Israel has demonstrated that willingness before. Operation Opera in 1981, the strike on Iraq's Osirak reactor, was a unilateral Israeli operation that the U.S. opposed at the time. Operation Orchard in 2007, the strike on Syria's suspected reactor at Al-Kibar, same pattern. Israel has a doctrine of preemptive action against nuclear threats in the region. The difference here is that seizing material is much harder than destroying a reactor. A reactor you can bomb from the air. HEU metal in an underground bunker requires boots on the ground, inside the facility, handling the material directly.
Israel's special forces are highly capable, but they're operating at the far edge of their logistical reach. Fordo is about 1,600 kilometers from Israel. That's a long helicopter flight, even with aerial refueling.
The distance is a major constraint. An MH-47G has a combat radius of about 370 kilometers without refueling. To reach Fordow, you'd need multiple refueling points, probably over Jordan and Iraq, which means you need overflight permissions, or you're accepting the diplomatic and military consequences of violating airspace. Or you stage the operation from a closer base, Azerbaijan maybe, or Iraqi Kurdistan, or a carrier in the Persian Gulf. Each option has political complications. The U.S. has more basing options and more aerial refueling capacity, but also more political constraints on unilateral action.
If we're being realistic, a raid of this type is almost certainly a U.S. operation, or a joint U.S.-Israeli operation with the U.S. providing the heavy lift, and Israel providing the targeting intelligence, and maybe the breach teams.
That's the most plausible scenario. The U.S. has the nest teams, the transport casks, the heavy helicopters, and the experience handling nuclear materials in field conditions. Israel has the human intelligence network inside Iran and the demonstrated willingness to act. Together, they could theoretically pull it off. But the coordination requirements are staggering. This is not a SEAL Team 6 raid on a compound in Abbottabad. This is a complex, multi-phase industrial operation conducted under fire, in a chemically and radiologically hazardous environment, with a ticking clock and a potentially catastrophic failure mode.
All of that assumes the material is where you think it is, in the form you think it's in, and that nobody moves it between when you get the intelligence and when you launch the raid.
That's the intelligence to operations gap. In the Iraq to Waitha case, the U.S. had weeks to plan and execute. In a hot raid scenario, the intelligence might be hours old by the time the team is on the ground. If Iran moves the material to a different building, or transfers it to a truck convoy, or disperses it to multiple sites, the raid team arrives at an empty room. That's the nightmare scenario, not that the team gets into a firefight, but that the material simply isn't there.
Which brings me to a question the prompt implies but doesn't ask directly. Is a raid even the best option? Or is the smarter play to hit the conversion infrastructure, the metallurgy facility, the casting furnaces, the machining labs, rather than trying to seize the material itself?
That's the debate within the planning community. Destroying the conversion infrastructure delays the weaponization timeline without the enormous operational risk of a material seizure. You can bomb a metallurgy lab from the air. You can sabotage it with cyber operations, like Stuxnet did to the centrifuges in 2010. You can target the scientists and engineers who know how to run the conversion process. Each of those options is less risky than a ground raid, and each buys time. The counterargument is that destroying infrastructure doesn't eliminate the material. The HEU still exists, and Iran can rebuild the conversion capability, probably faster the second time because they've already solved the engineering problems.
Seizing the material is the only option that definitively removes the threat. But it's also the option most likely to fail catastrophically.
That's the strategic box we're in, and it's why the policy focus has been on preventing enrichment to 90% in the first place, through sanctions, sabotage, diplomacy, and the threat of military action. Once the material exists, all the options are bad. The question is, which bad option is least likely to result in a nuclear detonation?
Let me shift to something more practical for listeners who are trying to follow this story. The next time a news report says Iran has 90% enriched uranium, what questions should they be asking to understand how close we actually are to a weapon?
First, in what form? If it's still UF6 in cylinders, that's weeks away from a weapon. If it's been converted to oxide, days to weeks. If it's metal, days. If it's machined metal hemispheres, hours to days. Second, where is it? If it's at a known, monitored facility, that's one thing. If it's at an undeclared site, the intelligence picture is much darker. Third, under what containment? If the III still has cameras and seals on the material, the international community has some visibility. If Iran has kicked out inspectors, we're flying blind. The answers to those three questions tell you more than the enrichment percentage alone.
The enrichment percentage is what the headlines focus on, because it's a simple number.
It's the glockenspiel of nuclear proliferation coverage. It makes a bright, simple sound that catches attention, but it tells you almost nothing about the actual music being played. 90% UF6 in a monitored vault at Natanz is a very different threat than 90% metal in an unmarked building outside Qom. Same number, entirely different security implications.
To wrap up the core of the prompt, the uranium at 90% is most likely UF6 solid in steel cylinders, or it's been converted to oxide powder or metal ingots depending on how far along the weaponization chain Iran has gone. It's stored in Type B containers under inert atmosphere in critically safe arrays, probably at Fordow or Natanz or a covert metallurgy site. And seizing it would require 100+ special operators with radiation gear and 30-ton transport casks, achieving total surprise, overcoming IRGC defenses, preventing a criticality accident, and extracting within 90 minutes, all based on intelligence that might be hours out of date. And nobody has ever actually done this.
That's the summary. And I want to emphasize one thing. The criticality risk is not a theoretical concern. It has killed people. Slotin in 1946, the Tokaimura workers in 1999. The operators at the Mayak facility in the Soviet Union. These accidents happen when trained professionals are handling nuclear materials in controlled settings. Now imagine doing it in a hostile facility, under fire, in the dark, with a countdown clock. The margin for error is essentially zero.
If the raid succeeds and the material is seized, what then? Iran still has the knowledge, the centrifuge technology, the metallurgy expertise. You've taken the material, but you haven't taken the capability. They can start enriching again.
That's the final strategic paradox. The material is fungible. The knowledge is not. Seizing the HEU buys time, maybe a year, maybe two, but it doesn't eliminate the threat permanently. The only thing that eliminates the threat permanently is a political settlement that Iran believes is in its interest to maintain, or a regime change that fundamentally alters Iran's strategic objectives. Everything else is delay and deterrence.
The raid is not a solution. It's a postponement. An extremely dangerous, extremely expensive postponement.
Which is why the entire edifice of non-proliferation policy is built on preventing the material from ever existing in the first place. Once it exists, you're managing a crisis, not solving a problem. And the tools for managing that crisis are all high risk, all uncertain, and all potentially catastrophic if they fail.
There's one more thing I want to touch on before we move toward closing. The prompt mentions the delivery mechanism, that once the material is on a missile and fired, the window for intervention closes. But that's actually not quite right. The window closes earlier than that. It closes when the pit is mated to the warhead, and the warhead is mated to the missile. At that point, you're not seizing material anymore. You're attempting to disable an armed nuclear weapon. That's a completely different problem set.
A much harder one. Once the weapon is assembled, any attempt to seize or disable it risks detonation. Not a full nuclear yield necessarily, but a conventional explosion that disperses the uranium as a radiological hazard. That's the dirty bomb scenario, and it's one of the reasons why the conversion phase is the preferred intervention point. You want to hit the material when it's still chemical, still in bulk form, still requiring further processing to become a weapon. Once it's a weapon, your options narrow to essentially two: preemptive strike to destroy it in place, accepting the radiological consequences, or deterrence, based on the threat of retaliation.
Which brings us back to where we started. The physical form of the material is the single most important variable in this entire scenario. It determines what options are available, what risks are present, and how much time remains.
That's the framework I'd want listeners to take away. The next time you see a headline about Iran's enrichment level, don't just note the percentage. Ask what form the material is in, where it's located, and what the IAEI can still see. Those questions tell you whether we're talking about a diplomatic problem, an intelligence problem, or a military problem. And the answer changes everything.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest buzkashi tournament ever recorded took place in N'Djamena, Chad, in 1937, featuring over 1,000 horsemen competing across a 6-day event for a prize of 200 camels and a French colonial medal of honor.
200 camels seems like a logistical challenge in itself.
Where do you even keep 200 camels? All right, then.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify.
We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.